From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Facebook when a man in Pennsylvania made threats about his estranged wife. In fact, Anthony Ilonis not only wrote about gruesomely killing his wife, he wrote about killing an entire kindergarten class and an FBI agent. Some of the threats were so vulgar that we can't repeat them here. Ilonis was convicted on 4 counts of threats and sentenced to 44 months in prison. But Ilonis challenged his conviction on First Amendment grounds, and his case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And just days ago, the Supreme Court ruled in Ilonis' favor. It was the first time the court raised the implications of free speech on social media. The justices decided that it wasn't enough to convict Ilonis based solely on the idea that a reasonable person would regard his communications as a threat. Now, their decision did shock many observers who thought Ilonis' graphic and multiple comments were clearly threatening. This hour, we're going to examine a number of recent cases in the news, from the Facebook threats to the Buffalo Jills and legislation designed to protect cheerleaders' pay, to Governor Cuomo's wage board that is looking at the minimum wage for the fast food sector, and more. My guest can help us understand these cases. In studio for the hour, Justin Cordello's here. He's an employment and labor law attorney with Cordello Law. Justin, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me today, Evan.
Scott Maloof's here, an attorney who specializes in the use of social media as evidence. He's a good friend of this program, has helped us on a lot of cases in the past. I should say, help us understand cases. You haven't actually been employed by WXXI, so there's no quid
correct pro
quo there. No. Nice to have you, Scott.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
All right. I want to start there with the Ilonis case, Scott. We talked about it last year. That decision did surprise observers, and that's sort of a cheap way to start. I don't want to make you just the critic of the Supreme Court, but were you surprised by their decision?
I don't think I was surprised in the sense that they were very careful about what they ruled on, in the sense that this was not a big First Amendment case. They were very careful about ruling on the federal statute at issue, the threat statute, and saying, what is the specific issue here under the statute? And the majority of the court did not reach the First Amendment. It was only Justice Thomas in his dissent who talked about the First Amendment.
Okay, so, you know, when Ilonis appealed and so much of the media reported on the grounds of the appeal, we're sort of focusing on the wrong thing, I guess, which is easy to do. But let's talk about the threat then. Even under the threat statute, as you said, you look at what Ilonis wrote, and you know, I got to be careful here. I don't want to read everything he wrote, but I'm just looking at some of the things he wrote. I can't. It is remarkable. It's not one time. It's not jumping on Facebook saying, "I wish my wife were dead."
Right.
I hate my wife. It was multiple comments about graphically killing her, what her body would look like. Revenge is a dish that is best served cold with a delicious side of psychological torture. He talked about, do you know that it's illegal for me to say I want to kill my wife? It's illegal. It's indirect criminal contempt. It's one of the only sentences I'm not allowed to say. And he goes on and on and on to talk about how he's willing to fight for his right to say he wants to kill her, even if he ends up in jail. He talked about what would happen if he killed an entire kindergarten class, the body of an FBI agent. I mean, I can't even read all of this, Scott. I know you've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't just one time.
Right.
Let's talk about what a person would think when they saw that. I mean, people are saying, how does that not constitute an illegal threat?
Mm-hmm.
What essentially is the Supreme Court telling us?
I think you've got to flip the first question on its head and say, if you're a Supreme Court justice and you're writing a decision that has to guide a nation of 300 some odd million people and guide prosecutors all across the country, you've got to ask yourself, as horrible as what he said was, what kind of clear guidance can I give so that we're not talking 2 or 3 years from now about a high school student who in an imprudent moment, you know, wrote a few things that were very, very silly. And then you have a prosecutor who decides, I'm going to make an example of this person. And so that's kind of how the Supreme Court comes back on these, as well as trying to provide as narrow a guidance as they can. And that's why they talked about the statute instead of talking about the First Amendment.
Okay. And you know, in my own perspective, not being an attorney, I understand very well the point you're making. We all have had bad moments where we've either said things we regretted, maybe we texted something we regretted, maybe we left a voicemail, or maybe we made a post on social media that we regretted. It can happen. So I understand the feeling that you set a precedent here, you got to be very careful for that reason. I'm looking at this saying it wasn't one post, it wasn't one day, it was repeated, graphic, vulgar at length. But the Supreme Court, I guess, Scott, may tell me, okay, Evan, but is five comments the threshold? You know, how many is more than one comment the threshold that constitutes a threat? So even logically to me, I'm saying this is multiple threats about killing a person, an FBI agent in a kindergarten class. There's still some murkiness, I guess, about what constitutes a real threat.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think, first of all, they didn't really look at this quantitatively. They didn't say, right. Was it one, right. Five, or 50? They really look at it qualitatively to say what exactly was said and what's the context. If you really break down all of the opinions, you kind of have the lowest standard, which was Justice Thomas, who said it's really a general standard, you know, and what we're talking about is mens rea, the intent to do something. And his was, it's a very low standard. Evan, did you intend to say that thing? And then what's the context here? And you know, Justice Thomas would have said, yes, he intended to say it. And in this context, you know, a reasonable person would perceive it as a threat, and he would have upheld the conviction. And then you walk up, there's one more standard, which was Justice Alito, who said, I don't buy what Justice Thomas is saying. I would look at his mental state of, was it reckless for him to say this? You know, and in this context, Justice Alito would have said, that's the question the Third Circuit should have asked itself. Is it reckless? You know, and we don't have an answer to that question. The interesting thing was the majority said, we don't know what the standard is, but we know it's not the reasonable person standard that the jury was given. And so that's kind of where we're left with this, which was they didn't give us a standard. They just said, this ain't it. And then finally, you had what Alonis pushed, which nobody on the court bought, which was you have to have a really specific showing that, yes, Evan, I intended to threaten my wife.
He has said that, I think he has said that he was venting, that he was emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Let me grab a question from Jake, who's listening now. And Jake says, how clear was it from his posts that these were lyrics? And I think what Jake is saying is, some of what Alonis was posting was referencing other things. It was sort of a takeoff of song lyrics or posting directly song lyrics or referencing, I think one of them was an online sketch that talked about the president. He sort of reworked it to talk about his wife.
Right.
Jake says, how clear was it from his post that these were lyrics? That seems to be the key here, legally at least.
Well, I think Jake is putting his finger on something that's really important in the context of technology and social media and the life we live in now, which is, you know, a lot of these things get decontextualized. Specifically here, Alonis himself interspaced what you read with statements of, these are just lyrics, this is a fantasy. He changed his name to Tone Dougie, saying he was an aspiring rap artist. And so, you know, and I know you're shaking your head saying, you know, here's a guy who's doing it. But if you have 50 or 100 people who are legitimate, you know, artists out there and writing about it or talking about it in different mediums, that becomes very hard for a court or for a prosecutor to suss out. So the specific answer is it wasn't just one threat. It was one threat, a bunch of materials, disclaimers, and then another threat or okay. Alleged threat.
And interestingly enough, Jake also sends a link saying, and I'm not saying this proves anything, but Anthony Alonis, he now faces an assault charge after he's the guy at the center of this. Mm-hmm. He apparently tossed a flower pot at his girlfriend's mother's head or something, mm-hmm. and so now he's facing assault charges. But it's neither here nor there, unfortunately, that outcome. I think it's the question of what the Supreme Court considers. So what questions are still in play for you as an attorney? What still needs to be answered here?
Well, I think you've got to wait. In this specific case, we're going to have to go back. It'll go back to the Third Circuit, which is the court that controls Pennsylvania or covers Pennsylvania. And they will decide what the appropriate standard was. And, you know, the parties will then be working out. Is it a retrial? Can they do a plea or something in between?
Jack writes, your guest used the phrase reasonable person. I feel like we hear that in court cases a lot. Can you explain what that means?
Well, we could if we had 5 hours, I suppose.
It's a good question. I understand Jack's question.
It's an excellent question. And I think the end of the day, the simplest way to say it is it all depends on context. In the sense, I was thinking about that on the way here, you know, and what would a reasonable person perceive as a threat? If you're Eminem and you were putting out lyrics just as Mr. Alonis did on Facebook, but you're 3,000 miles away from your ex-wife, I think no one would perceive in that context that he was genuinely threatening her, versus Mr. Alonis, who presumably lived in the same town, didn't have millions of followers, and was writing these things. That's where reasonable person comes in. We take all those external facts and we say, what would the average Joe or Jane say in this situation? And it can be a really difficult standard to apply, and that's why there's so many questions.
Mim on Twitter says, when do things go from freedom of speech to harassment? I guess that's part of the question here.
It all depends on context. I mean, before the show started, we were also talking about employment. And, you know, you have that issue come up all the time of, you know, where is that line between me getting to say something that's, you know, my inherent, we all believe in that, you know, freedom of speech versus it's something that harasses somebody. And a good example is timing. You know, Evan, you and I could have, we could have a concert on the lawn of your house at 2 p.m. on a Saturday. Nobody would have a problem with it. 2 a.m. on a Sunday, they would. And that's a good example of how you start to draw those lines, you know, all reasonable place and reasonable time.
Caleb on Twitter says, another case of local interest you could look at is the University of Rochester's request to Yik Yak. And actually, it's a good point, Caleb. We have covered that on this program in recent months. In fact, it's not just the University of Rochester. SUNY Brockport has also had issues with this. In fact, there was a group of students who engaged in a Black Lives Matter march and event. I think it was in December. And Yik Yak, if you don't know Yik Yak, it is a social media application that is... I guess, Scott, it's like a real-time community bulletin board. How do you describe it?
The simplest way to describe it is its most unique feature, it's geography-based. If you turn it on your phone, the app draws a circle around your phone, anywhere from a mile and a half to 10 miles. And it's anonymous, so you can post anything you want, and for the most part, no one else will know who posted that.
Right.
And it's incredibly popular on college campuses, and it's also sort of leaking down into high schools and middle schools. And the problem, as you've highlighted in your past programs, is 95% of people use it and don't create a problem, but then you have some racist posts, homophobic posts, you have individual names being used or threats being made.
Right.
And it's created a lot of problems for colleges. You know, a couple local, Colgate University also had some similar problems with those issues. On the flip side, though, Yik Yak has been a very good resource for reporters. When Ted Cruz announced his presidential run, it was at Liberty University, and reporters in the stadium were watching Yik Yak to see live what students' views were. And so it provided very candid feedback that would not have been otherwise available.
Sure. There's always unintended consequences. If the idea is, hey, real time, if there's events happening, you can communicate. If the unintended consequence is, hey, anonymous protection for racist, homophobic, or threats, what do you do about that? And to Scott's point there, University of Rochester has had, and other universities, Colgate, the New York Times has reported on this, you'll have a college professor teaching a class, and somewhere in that class, you've got a student talking about killing the professor. And the professor has no idea who's actually doing it, can't know, and feels totally disrupted, understandably so. In the Brockport example, you had the Black Lives Matter event, and you had some students talking about showing up for a lynching. Obviously felt like a threat to those students who were marching. So what do you think is going to happen here? You've had universities asking Yik Yak, hey, either shut this down or recalibrate what you do, or help us figure out who's writing those notes that feel like threats. What do you think they're going to do? What could they do?
Well, I think, you know, so far what we've seen, at least locally and Wells with some other schools, if there's a genuine threat, you know, criminal authorities, law enforcement authorities have been involved, and Yik Yak, like all other social media sites, has cooperated. And so those have been investigated, and there have been prosecutions.
But who decides what a genuine threat is? I guess that's the line.
That's the job of that, and that's the job sort of your law enforcement. On the flip side, with regard to some of that lesser stuff, we have seen Yik Yak has pretty much not responded to any of the universities. I know locally they have not seen anything, and they've stood on their rights and their defenses legally. And I think, again, it's like every tool. Even if you take Yik Yak out of the equation, you can have Twitter accounts that are on anonymous or unknown handles, and you can have the same kind of material posted. And so as an organization or as a community, you've really got to say, what are we doing as a group? This is just something that reflects what's going on in our community. How can we dig deeper and deal with the underlying issue, not just kind of aim at the technology?
Listeners, we're trying to answer your questions that have been coming in on Twitter, at Evan Dawson on Twitter. You can also email the program. If you go to wxxinews.org/connections, you'll find a way to do that there. Or you can call the program, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. It's not just a social media hour. In fact, it's more of a legal roundtable. We're looking at issues in the news recently with a couple of attorneys in town who specialize in these various areas and who can help us understand these various issues. Scott Maloof, an attorney who specializes in the use of social media as evidence. Justin Cordello, an employment and labor law attorney with Cordello Law here. Another case that does involve, maybe both of you can kind of help weigh in on. First of all, Justin Cordello is an employment law attorney. People have been, it's sort of a new world when it comes to, people have been complaining about their bosses since employment happened, you know, probably 10,000 years ago, you know. So people have always complained about bosses, right? That's not anything new. I assume you weren't there 10,000 years
ago. No, but I think you're right. I mean, workplace gripes have predate, you know,
social
pretty
media,
much.
Facebook.
Exactly.
Mark Zuckerberg didn't invent this. But general viewpoint first. What do you tell people about, I'm frustrated, I want to vent, I'm going to get on Facebook, and you say...
I tell all my clients that social media is not your friend when it comes to your job. I basically tell them to not post anything regarding, you know, anything involving the workplace, that really nothing good can come from it. It will only haunt them down the road one way or another. Granted, most of the folks I'm talking to are coming to me with a workplace
already
concerned grievance or issue.
It's too late.
Yeah, exactly. So we're trying not to dig any deeper here, and we're trying to, you know, not create an evidence trail, because in talking to and dealing with a lot of local employers, one of the first things they themselves do or their attorneys will do is look at someone's social media profile. And a lot of folks, especially the younger generation, they don't set up their privacy settings in such a way to, you know, allow folks not to see what's going on their social media accounts. So they're fully exposed. So everything that they post on their walls or other folks post on their wall is completely public. And that can be a real problem.
Okay, we actually have a very specific question from a listener about exactly that. And we're going to get to that in a moment. But first, let me get to a story in the news right now, which is out of Florida. And here's the story. The principal of North Miami Senior High School inadvertently injected himself into the racially charged national debate over police treatment of the black community with a social media comment, and it wound up costing him his job. The Miami-Dade County School District announced Wednesday that Alberto Iber has been removed as principal after going online to defend a white Texas police officer who waved a gun at black teenagers while responding to a call about an unruly pool party. And I'm sure you know the story by now from McKinney, Texas. Cell phone footage captured the officer, David Eric Casebolt, throwing a black teenage girl to the ground, then briefly drawing his gun while responding to a call about that party. The principal of this Florida school, Alberto Iber, jumped in a brief public post on a story on the Miami Herald's website, defended the officer's response. And using Facebook to comment through the site, here's what he wrote. Quote, he did nothing wrong. He was afraid for his life. I commend him for his actions. That's what the principal of the school wrote. In a brief statement, the school district said that employees are required to conduct themselves both personally and professionally in a manner that represents the school district's core values. The district said a replacement would be named shortly and that Iber would be reassigned to administrative duties. And their statement was the following, quote, judgment is the currency of honesty. Insensitivity, intentional or perceived, is both unacceptable and inconsistent with our policies, but more importantly with our expectation of common sense behavior that elevates the dignity and humanity of all, beginning with children, end quote. So the principal's fired. Scott Maloof, he uses Facebook to make the comment on this website. He's out of a job. All he said was, hey, I think that officer did the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing, I imagine you and your colleagues across the country who deal with social media are probably seeing more questions like this come up.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, going back to something Justin said, which was, you know, why are you sharing it in the first place? And I think, you know, that's probably the most important thing you've got to ask yourself, whether you're involved in employment litigation or any kind of litigation or not. Why are you doing this? My wife will tell you all the time that I interject myself into conversations on Twitter, on social media, and she just shakes her head and says, why are you doing
What's
that?
The risk-reward here? The reward is you get to be part of a conversation. Maybe you can change a person's mind. The risk might be, in this case for the principal, his job. But he will argue, hey, that's not fair. I made a post because I thought the officer was right. You can't fire me for that.
Well, I mean, he can make that argument, but I would say again, look at it from the employer's perspective. And let me share another story. You know, My wife and I, we recently went down to Florida, went to some of the attractions like Disney, et cetera, and we were looking at some of them. And there was one where an employee posted a review. So on Google, reviewing his own amusement park, and he used his real name. And he talked about how horrible it was to watch all the guests and their snot-nosed kids for 8 hours a day. And yeah, we're all laughing. And he talked about that, and he puts his real name on. So let's look at the employer's dilemma. If the employer chastises him, you know, now he's in a position where the individual says, hey, this is my right to say this stuff, and maybe he's going to bring a claim, claiming some other kind of, you know, problem, such as I've got a discrimination claim, I've got a prior, you know, I'm a whistleblower, et cetera, et cetera. But look at the flip side. The employer does nothing. They've sent the message because the employee will tell other employees, you can do whatever you want, and you're going to undermine your employer. So it's a no-win situation. So I've got a lot of empathy for both sides of that, but you've got to consider that before you post. You may be putting your employer in a bad position.
Do we know yet, by the way, Justin, if Alberto Iber came to Cordello Law and said, hey, man, they can't fire me over this?
I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, would I take Alberto's case? I think the first thing I'd want to look at is there a collective bargaining agreement that covers Alberto? You know, public school teachers, principals traditionally have those types of protections where the employer has to establish just cause for the termination, kind of progressive corrective discipline, things of that nature. So if he has those protections, Cordello Law would likely take the case. Without those protections, though, if he's just an employee at will, it's a tougher case for sure, because the litigation that would ensue would be in federal court and involve some pretty complicated issues, whether or not his speech was protected by First Amendment. And those aren't issues that get resolved quickly. That would be a pretty lengthy and in-depth litigation. And his best bet might be to, you know, recant and look, you know, down the road at how he can secure employment at another district. I assume he's a professional. He wants to stay working as a principal. So that might be his best course of action as opposed to conducting litigation and probably having to look to relocate or start a new career.
And I think we also might look at what has the district done in other cases of this happening. You know, I think you see this again and again with a lot of employees. So we might be able to point to, are you doing something, you know, inordinate for this gentleman because it has become public as opposed to what other employees have done in the past?
Our engineer is also a former public school teacher, and that's John Andrus. And John just sent me a note saying, could be that the district has a policy about administrators maybe are not allowed to make political statements without checking with central office. Now, I've heard of those kind of policies before. Does that kind of policy stand up legally?
Well, it certainly would in the sense that the employer now can show that they have a policy in place and they're applying their policy. They're okay. Not treating this principal any differently than they would anyone else. And they have to enforce the policy that they've adopted. They can't decide willy-nilly that we're going to apply it in some situations and not apply it in others.
In other words, the district could say, it's not about the content of what he said. He could have said, that police officer was wrong. You know, he should never do that. The district would say, our policy is you don't make any of those kind of comments, no matter what side. It's not about choosing a side.
Insubordination. Failure to adhere to, you know, district policy.
Interesting. Okay.
Which is probably a much better case for them, easier and cleaner for them as
well. And where was it? We had those comments from this morning. Look at this. The host's notes are too copious right now. here it is. Hi, Evan. Can your guest settle once and for all whether someone can get fired for complaining about their boss on Facebook? I always hear different things. Alberto Iber did not lose his job as principal for complaining about a boss. It was about for weighing in on a position that the district viewed as political. And as we've been talking about complaining about your boss, it can be murky. In general, Justin Cordello's advice is don't complain about your boss on Facebook. Just find a way to vent otherwise. But
You know, we're employees at will. And, you know, the employee at will doctrine really doesn't offer you any protections for complaining about your boss at work or on social media. So if you wouldn't do something or say something to your boss in person, I wouldn't do it via social media and thinking that suddenly because you're doing it off your phone or off a computer or an iPad that suddenly you have some legal protections.
But someone will say, well, but counselor, I did this on Facebook on a private account, not on Twitter for the whole world to see it. Is there a difference?
is your account truly private? Would be the response to that. It's hard to know. And, you know, a lot of folks might think that their privacy settings are set up in such a way that it is private, but, you know, sometimes they're not. And sometimes things can get reposted by other friends or blasted in ways that you never intended.
You know, and we often get distracted by the privacy settings argument in two ways. One, people say, well, I set this at maximum privacy setting, and let's say they have done that. They think that that's some sort of shield to a court inquiring into the existence of the documents. And again, we've seen for the most part, it is not. And so people should not think that that's going to protect them in the legal sense. But secondly, as Justin said, the bigger risk is it your coworkers. These things come up all the time. It's not somebody in the boss's office was surfing the internet and found it. It's the coworker is frustrated with something you've done or something has happened repeatedly, and they go, oh, I'm going to show this to the boss. That's how this comes up again and again.
Here's an email from Greg that came in this morning. My daughter's 23 and a recent college graduate. She got her first job just a month out of school, or at least she thought she did. She had a job offer, but before she started, the company rescinded the offer after they claimed they found problematic things on her Facebook page. My daughter isn't perfect, but I don't think there was too much there beyond the occasional shot of her holding a beer can. My instinct was to tell her the company had no right to do that, but she has moved on. Start with Justin. What do you think?
Yeah, unfortunately, this is a situation that I've seen in this past year come up at least three different times. And it's extremely frustrating for the individual because they've relied on this job offer. Sometimes they've relocated or they've rescinded other job offers in anticipation of starting with a particular employer. To have the position rescinded, if there was a contract at issue where his daughter had signed a contract, she might have some contractual claims. However, most, you know, younger folks starting out, usually it's not a contract-based right. position. So unfortunately, we fall back into that employment at will type area where there's not a lot of rights. Now, there's certain common law claims that we could pursue, promissory estoppel, detrimental reliance. You know, we relied on, you know, to her detriment in starting this position. But again, that's a bit of an uphill battle. And really, who wants to fight for a job where the employer really doesn't want you there to begin with, number one? And then number two, you know, American civil justice system is really about damages, economic damages. And her economic damages, they're going to be difficult to quantify, because how do you convince a jury that you should be paid your full wages for the next year when you never step foot on the worker's premise?
Does Greg have a right, or does Greg's daughter have a right to at least try to find out what was it on my page? You know, because Greg's saying, hey, I couldn't even find anything on my daughter's page. She was holding a beer can in one shot. Didn't look like anything, you know, sort of outlandish.
Exactly. No, I mean, Greg definitely, or Greg's daughter, can inquire to HR. I mean, I understand I'm not allowed to work for this company any longer, but what is it that was so objectionable on my Facebook status? Likely the employer will not respond to that.
Okay, yeah. So they don't have a right to that knowledge?
No, I don't believe there's any right to that knowledge. Employers can make decisions whether or not to hire individuals all the time. If the decision was based on some protected category, if that's what Greg's daughter or Greg believes is going on, then maybe there would be a case where they're discriminating against her because, well, we hired her, but we didn't realize that she was hearing impaired. And then we look on her Facebook account and we see that she wears hearing aids, and we're not willing to accommodate someone like that. Maybe in that context, there would be a claim to pursue on her behalf. But, you know, it's very situational, and you'd have to see what kind of protected categories his daughter did or did not fall into.
And you say in recent months you've seen more of these kind of cases, three in the last year.
Yes. Unfortunately, this kind of happens from time to time where employers, I think, someone makes a decision to hire an employee, and then someone else objects to that decision, and they rescind the offer. And it's very difficult to advise folks because Unfortunately, there's just not a lot of protections for them in that situation, absent there being some employment contract. And as I said, most folks don't have contracts that cover their employment.
Okay. Greg, we hope we answered that question for you, and sorry about that, but thank you for the email. We're going to get a short break in and come back and talk about other cases in the news with our legal panel for the hour, Justin Cordello, an employment and labor law attorney with Cordello Law, Scott Maloof, an attorney who specializes in the use of social media as evidence, and scottmaloof.com, is that right, Scott?
That's right.
M-A-L-O-U-F, and it's cordellolaw.com for Justin's firm. So let's get a short break and come right back with more of your questions and a look at other cases in the news on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, some of the most iconic moments in history have been captured on camera, and many of those cameras are on display at the George Eastman House. That's why the George Eastman House is about to receive a national honor for its technology collection. We're going to take a tour through history. What are some of these cameras? What were the models that captured the moments? How did the George Eastman House get these cameras, and how can you see them? It's all next hour.
Inmates in solitary confinement are often the most dangerous. So why do they go from isolation to freedom without mental health care or job training?
I went from solitary confinement straight to my mom's. No reintegration. I begged for help. Get me ready. Help me.
Solitary to the Streets later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That'll be this afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Here's another listener question. One more question on the Facebook subject, because I think it's timely based on what we've been discussing. They write, if an employer requests access to your Facebook account on what otherwise might be private, what options does a potential or current employee have? I've heard of a few employers that do this. So they want direct access to your account. Gentlemen?
I can take that one. This is Scott. Basically, there are 21 states that have laws regarding this. It's called password protection or social media protection. And started about 5-6 years ago when Maryland had a gentleman interviewing for be a corrections officer. And the individual interviewing him asked for that kind of access. And then that literally sparked a nationwide movement. And the 21 states, New York is not one of them. And the protections are generally for exactly that, which say an employer cannot ask you to see your social media. They cannot ask for your password. They cannot ask for you to accept a friend request. But again, New York does not currently protect you in that situation.
Do you think that that will change, given the fact that 21 other states have addressed that?
I think so. I think we're looking at the fact that a lot of employers, and an interesting thing is employers are utilizing social media in a lot of different ways, such as asking employees to have an account so they can advertise. So, for example, if you're an employer who makes a product that you sell around the world and you've got an employee who really understands how they use it and they speak Portuguese, maybe you ask that employee to promote it in Portuguese on social media. And so that kind of begins this intermix of the personal and the employer. So you're going to see, I think, New York eventually is going to join those states to say, protect the password. I would add just kind of one more caveat, which is, do you really want to work for an employer who does that? I mean, that might be a position where, similar to what Justin was saying, you push back a little bit and say, why would you want that? Because I think the better employers are going to say, there's a lot of information in there we don't want, and we don't want to have a reputation for making decisions like that or making requests like that.
Justin, thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've never come across an employer, insisting on employees' password. And as Scott was saying, I mean, they're just opening themselves up to all types of issues.
Well, let me give you an example. My last, if you look up Evan Dawson on Twitter, well, there's lots of Evan Dawsons in the world. If you look up me on Twitter, you're going to find two accounts, one that's active and one that is dormant. My last employer, when new ownership came in, told the employees, we own your Twitter account. It's ours. You leave the company, you got to shut it down. It's ours. And by this time, I don't know, how many followers I had, but I'd been working on the account, and I thought, I don't know if I'll work here forever. I have no plans to leave, but I thought, that's not your account, that's mine. And I was instructed otherwise, so my instinct was to create a separate account that the company could own. And I tweeted a lot less frequently from it, And when I left that company, that account has gone dormant. So now, at my old company, you will find most employees have a couple of different accounts. It's a strange arrangement. I don't think it makes a whole lot of sense. But that's the corporate policy. I followed it. And instead of challenging and pushing back, Justin, if I really wanted to push back, I mean, they're saying, hey, we own your account. You know, if you're tweeting, you know, and you work for us, that Twitter account's ours.
I mean, I think your situation is unique, Evan, in the sense that, you know, you're a public personality. You're a broadcaster. So part of your, you know, employment with your former employer was, you know, you communicating with the public. Mm-hmm. And Twitter, I would assume, is just like another forum for you to communicate with the public. So they might be in a better position to...
I was hoping you'd take my side here.
I know. No, I do think you the way you handled it made a lot of sense, is to, you know, create a separate account where it's truly Evan Dawson, care of no one else, no other corporate ownership, just truly your personal Twitter account versus your company Twitter account.
So the bifurcation of those things made sense. It was a good idea. You'd have said smart move.
Exactly, because, you know, in your line of work, having a Twitter account is essential.
Yeah,
and growing, you know, your Twitter following is essential. And like you said, you know, in today's day and age, there's no guarantees. No one works really anywhere for 30 years any longer. Except for, I guess, you know, Don Elhart.
But he does. But he's looking at 50 years.
50
next
years,
year.
Excuse me. Yeah, my entire life, he's been broadcasting here in Rochester. Yeah. But most folks now, you know, you put your 5 to 7 years someplace and you look to move on, and to then have to lose your entire Twitter following or your Facebook following or whatever it might be. I mean, that's probably a major asset to you when looking at a prospective employer.
And picking up on that word, asset, in the sense that it is really important to you as the individual, because you put yourself in it and you tweet at all hours and you really engage with people. But it's not an asset for the corporation. And you were kind of in a bad position because people come in and they say, we want to own this account. And then, you know, when I talk to people, I say, but you're not owning anything. If Evan's not there populating that account with material, if he's not interacting with people, you own nothing. And that's what your former employer has. They have an account. They've got a name. But there's no there. And I bet if we went back and looked at it, a lot fewer followers.
No doubt about it.
Yeah, there's no value to it. So why did you institute that policy as opposed to saying maybe we incentivize you to promote the station's Twitter feed or to promote a bunch of them that we as a station own and can populate in multiple ways and use technology to make even more valuable?
Dumb policy, if you ask me. For that. but doesn't mean that they were legally incorrect, is what Justin is saying. Just the bad move, anyway. David on Twitter wants to know, did you guys already talk about the GoDaddy case with the engineer applicant referred to as an obese Christian? I haven't heard about that case.
No, right? I haven't heard that one either.
So, David, I don't know about that case and apologize for that, but if you want to follow up on Twitter, let us know what you're talking about there. There have been a number of other cases that we wanted to get feedback from our legal panel. Justin Cordello and Scott Maloof are with us in studio. You might have seen the case last year about the Buffalo Jills, the Buffalo cheerleaders, who some of them were just, I think, understandably upset with low pay, very low wages. The team was saying that, well, we don't hire the cheerleaders, and sort of a contractor that we bring on, they hire and employ. The cheerleaders were not paid well. They were subjected to what they called jiggle tests for fat content, which was an unbelievably stupid and sexist thing, but it did happen. Some of the cheerleaders had to go to corporate events with some big community members. They were told to sit on people's laps on golf carts. It was ugly. And now New York State's considering, my understanding, Justin Cordello, is they're considering legislation that would address some of this?
Yes. This is fairly recent legislation that's been proposed. And to be candid with you, Evan, in no way do I condone what happened to the Buffalo Jills. I've dedicated my legal practice to representing employees, workers' rights. But for me, this legislation smacks of a political stunt or a gimmick. Hmm. You know, it's not going to pass. And in fact, you know, it's redundant for laws that are already on the books. And it'll have little impact. To me, this is a couple assembly people and senators, state senators, looking to get some attention from the media, because this is, you know, a bit of a sexy topic, talking about cheerleaders, professional cheerleaders. But the legislation would really just affect professional cheerleaders for the Buffalo Bills, the Brooklyn Nets, and the New York Knicks. The Giants, the Jets, those are, you know, New Jersey organizations, yeah. Unfortunately. So very limited impact. And, you know, frankly, you know, really what this boils down to is whether or not these folks are truly independent contractors. And federal and state law already speaks to those issues of whether or not cheerleaders are should be considered independent contractors or not. You know, the current Jills case is going to settle, is my strong opinion. It hasn't settled yet. And
how could they not have settled? The Pegulas are so smart. They come in, and by the way, when the Pegulas became the owners of the Buffalo Bills, this case was already going on. They could have come in, Justin, and said, hey, this is a case that happened before we got here. New sheriffs in town. We're not going to tolerate this. Whether or not the Bills technically employed the Jills or an independent contractor did, the treatment was not okay. We will settle it and move on. I don't know why it hasn't settled. Does that surprise you?
It does, especially given that, you know, Tampa Bay Buccaneers and the Oakland Raiders recently settled very similar cases. Pretty decent sized settlements when you think we're talking high six figures, low seven figures.
But not for the value of an NFL franchise. I mean, that's a lot of money, but $800,000, $1 million for an NFL franchise, as opposed to endless headlines about jiggle tests, I think I'm going to go ahead and settle.
No, I agree. I'm really kind of baffled why Buffalo hasn't stepped in and just absorbed this financial hit. But, you know, there's something to be said that a lot of the damage has already been done. And settling the case now, the media damage is already done, doesn't really matter.
But what if it's the right thing to do? I mean, it probably is the right thing to do. And Justin's right. We're not talking about a whole lot of people, the Buffalo Jills, but they were told, you know, I think they were told, isn't this a nice opportunity? You get to come, you get to support the team, you get to have exposure that might help you get jobs elsewhere. And part of the argument is, if they're working, they're working. You can't pay them $1 an hour, which is sort of what it came down to.
It's atrocious what happened to the Jills. Completely atrocious, so much so that they're enacting or trying to enact legislation for this very specific issue. But unfortunately, in my experience, these are the types of issues I see day in and day out for folks working in less high-profile positions than NFL cheerleaders. You know, for instance, there are many more exotic dancers in this state than there are cheerleaders. And exotic dancers are almost always treated as independent contractors, even though they're really, truly employees. And different clubs do not pay them proper minimum wage. But
they get paid less than minimum wage. I guess they rely on tips or whatever?
Correct.
Boy.
And okay. They're responsible for tipping out other individuals at the different clubs.
So anyway, what Justin is saying about it's called the Cheerleaders Fair Pay Act. You're saying it's so limited in scope, it smacks to you of a political stunt.
It does, and good-natured political stunt. I mean, my practice is dedicated to representing workers and fighting for workers' rights. But, you know, with all the issues that Albany's dealing with right now, protecting basically the cheerleaders for three teams, I don't think rises to the level of needing an act of you know, the legislature in Albany, given that the Jills are already embroiled in class action litigation. And, you know, the Nets and the Knicks, I'm sure, are in compliance at this point.
Especially
given
looking around, yes.
Exactly. So, you know, I think it's good-natured political stunt, but at the same time, I don't think it will pass.
And you think the Jills will win in this case?
Oh, definitely. I don't see how a jury could ever return a verdict in their favor, given the completely egregious, you know, allegations and testimony that have already been offered in that case.
Okay. And we also wanted to ask Justin about the governor's wage board. Governor Andrew Cuomo, well, in New York State, has something called a wage board. And the governor has asked the wage board to look at the minimum wage for fast food workers. You might have heard about the so-called Fight for 15 recently. And you know what? Before we get to the Fight for 15, let me just jump back. Carol in Rochester wants to jump in on the Buffalo Jill. So while we're on that subject, let me bring in Carol. Go ahead, Carol.
Yeah, I just wondered if your panelists could comment on if there has been other states that have had this issue with their sports teams and cheerleaders, and would it not be helpful for other teams and cheerleaders if New York State took some kind of legislative action in this regard?
You mean other teams outside of the...
Outside of New York State.
Outside of New... Okay, so a couple questions. So stay on the line, Carol. Justin, mm-hmm. She's asking, do other states have legislation similar? Justin, you were saying, apart from legislation, you have seen settlements. Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the Oakland Raiders. So they've addressed similar claims issues.
Correct. The claim basically is a misclassification claim that the cheerleaders have been misclassified as independent contractors and they're truly employees. And if they're truly employees, they're entitled to at least minimum wage for any hours that they work, and then time and a half or overtime for any hours they work over 40 hours. Those are the two minimum requirements under federal law that protects all employees across the country under the Fair Labor Standards Act.
And forget $8.75, the JILs came out to about a dollar an hour, I think is what they're saying. So, but Carol, you're asking if there's legislation in other states. I don't know. And Justin, I'm not familiar with other state legislation.
You know, I've never heard of any other states enacting a Cheerleader Fairness Pay Act. It's possible, but I'd be surprised.
Okay. Carol?
I understand. I wonder if there's any kind of, independent contractors, if they too are not required like an employer would be.
So if you're, Carol, if you're truly classified as an independent contractor, and most folks are not truly independent contractors, but if you do meet the requirements, then no, you're not entitled to minimum wage or overtime. You're a contractor. You're basically running your own business, and you're bargaining with another business regarding your services. So those types of protections aren't there for you. But in my experience, a lot of employers think that if I get this employee to sign this contract and it's called an independent contractor agreement, they're independent contractors. And courts look at those agreements all the time and say, you can have an individual sign anything. What we really got to do is look at what that individual is doing for you on a day-to-day basis. And that's the true test. So you look at a host of different factors to make that analysis. It's extremely fact-intensive and unique to, you know, each position.
Okay. Before we get to the end of the hour, real briefly on the minimum wage question, the so-called Fight for 15 is what fast food workers want. They want what they call a living wage, a fair wage. They want $15 an hour. Governor Cuomo asking the wage board to look at the issue. Justin Cordello, what's in play? What legal questions are in play regarding, you know, the fast food sector and minimum wage?
Legal issues are, I think, why are we just looking at fast food workers? And why aren't we looking at raising the minimum wage across the board for all employees? And the answer to that is that that's exactly what Governor Cuomo tried to do earlier this year in the, you know, Republican Senate, shut him down. So now what he's trying to do is work with large labor unions like the SEIU to try to target, you know, the fast food industry, which, you know, is the perennial punching bag for all of, you know, America's social ills. but in terms of what the legal issues are, you know, it's going to take the wage board making a pronouncement enacting that the minimum wage is going to be raised. I think the issue is really what more can we do beyond just raising the minimum wage. I think California has really done something interesting where they're phasing it in over time in terms of raising minimum wage and not doing it just for fast food workers, but doing it for all workers.
Okay, and real briefly, about a minute left here, Justin, is there a question that, let's just be hypothetical here, the wage board makes a recommendation, minimum wage for fast food workers should be $12 an hour, the governor says okay, he tries to go around the legislature, that would probably spark a battle there, but setting that aside, how do you even define what a fast food worker really is? I mean, are there sort of independent small burger joints that are, you know, LDR char put enchilada, is that fast food? How do you define these things?
Exactly. I mean, in looking at this proposed legislation or proposed bill, the definition of fast food worker is extremely vague. And it's not clear, are we talking about, are we going to exclude LDR Charpit because they only have one location, but we're going to now include Shaler's because Shaler's has three locations.
Right.
It seems a bit arbitrary and capricious. So there's going to be a lot of back and forth on this issue. I'm suspect that this gets passed. And this is really just political fodder for the 2016 presidential election. Hillary Clinton obviously is, you know, very much in support of raising minimum wage. And this is a way to get the country comfortable with raising minimum wage. If we're not going to do it for all employees, maybe we just do it industry by industry.
Well, I think a lot of folks I've talked to share your view that this probably won't go anywhere this year, but we've been surprised. I've been surprised by lots of things in the world.
Well, you know, Evan, when I was in last time, we were talking about New York raising the minimum wage rate for restaurant employees,
yep,
servers.
Tipped workers. Yep.
Tipped workers. And that's exactly what happened in February. They raised it. And by the end of the year, the new tipped rate for restaurant workers will be $7.50 an hour, which is a significant increase from where it is currently, which is basically $5 an hour. And that's going to affect a quarter of a million workers in the state.
Well, if the wage board goes ahead with anything, let's come back and we'll talk about it on a separate date. That will be interesting. There's a lot of things that surprised me. I didn't think the Cleveland Cavaliers would be up 2-1 in the NBA Finals. You know, there's a lot of things that have surprised me recently, so you just never know. Justin Cordello with Cordello Law. Online where, Justin?
www.cordellolaw.com.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Scott Maloof, online where, Scott?
I'm on Twitter at Scott Maloof, and as well as my website is scottmaloof.com.
M-A-L-O-U-F. And Scott, such a smart mind on social media and so many other things. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, short break and more connections straight ahead.